Yeshua introduces the Torah to the nations. Just before he went back to his father's throne from whence he came, the Messiah gave careful instructions for his Talmidim to follow. He told them in Matthew 28, verses 19 and 20, "As you are going, make disciples of all nations, immersing them in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Spirit of God." This passage, often referred to as the Great Commission by many believers, contains several points frequently overlooked by sincere Bible teachers in the churches. The first is the nature of the material Yeshua's followers were to teach to potential believers from the Gentiles. Yeshua refers to this material as "my commandments." The vast bulk of his teaching consisted of explicit Torah passages and Torah-based instruction. Moreover, since he was most likely speaking Hebrew to his Hebrew-speaking followers, he would have used the word mitzvot, which we have translated commandments. Mitzvot were part of the instructions of the Torah. In other words, it is not difficult to see that Yeshua would have been instructing his followers to teach the Torah, the teaching on God's righteousness, to those from among the Gentiles who would believe. This would have been perfectly consistent with the prophecy of Isaiah 56, which we examined above. Introducing the Gentile to the Torah. The next important passage relating to our subject is Acts 15. To be sure, this is not an easy passage to interpret. It is, however, an important passage for us because it contains a record of how the Gentile believers were received by the early Jewish followers of Yeshua. There are several things we can learn from this passage about how Gentile believers may relate to the Torah. The first point made by Acts 15 is that no one may follow Torah in order to achieve justification. Concerning this salvation, the leaders confirmed that, quote, "God made no distinction between us and them, for he purified their hearts by faith," end of quote. Verse 9. Having stated this truth, however, the chapter tells us that the Jewish leadership definitely had the Torah in the forefront of their minds. In verses 19 through 21, we see the leaders concluding that the new Gentile believers had a very definite relationship to the Torah. There were several aspects to this relationship. First, presumably to facilitate table fellowship between the Jewish and non-Jewish members of the body of Messiah, the Jerusalem elders instructed the non-Jewish believers to follow the parts of the Torah which had to do with the dietary laws. This was important because it was through sharing meals together that true fellowship and unity could be fostered between the once estranged cultures. It is at this point that many otherwise careful commentators fall into a trap. They assume that the Jewish leadership was requiring the Gentiles to follow something similar to the famous Noahide laws, a set of rules developed by the rabbis for Gentiles to follow in order to be considered righteous. It is true that the four requirements recorded in Acts 15 are very similar to these Noahide laws. However, we disagree with most interpretations of the reason for these requirements. Many teachers feel that since the rabbis required Gentiles to adhere to the Noahide laws, the Jewish leadership here is simply following suit, albeit on a somewhat limited basis. That may be true. However, there is a second, more probable explanation. The Jewish elders in Jerusalem were doing all they could to demonstrate grace, patience, and kindness to the Torah-illiterate Gentile believers. The Jewish believers had grown up with the Torah. Many had significant sections of it memorized. It was their life and breath, their joy and heartbeat. See Acts 21. But to the Gentiles, the Torah was a strange book. Many had never even been exposed to it before Shaul and other faithful followers of Yeshua brought them the message of Messiah. The Jerusalem elders knew this. They also knew that the only existing body of teaching for believers, Jewish or Gentile, was the Torah. However, the elders could not demand that the Gentile believers follow the Torah with the same intensity that they did. Therefore, by delineating the four Torah-based instructions for table fellowship in Acts 15, verses 19 and 20, the wise and loving elders were communicating to the Gentiles this message. You are equal to us in the body of Messiah. Our teachings are your teachings. But it will take you a while before you can understand the Holy Book, the Torah. Thus, for now, only learn what will best facilitate fellowship between you and your Jewish brothers and sisters. You will gradually learn more of what it means to walk with God as time goes by. We will send you qualified and trained Torah teachers. We find a confirmation of this interpretation in verse 21. After the elders wrote the teachings in verses 19 and 20, they made this rather cryptic statement to the Gentiles, quote, "For Moses has been preached in every city from the earliest times and is read in the synagogues on every Shabbat," end of quote. What is the meaning of this comment? It seems to make very little sense unless we understand it as the elders' encouragement of the Gentile believers to continue in their study of the Torah. And since Torah instruction was available in the local synagogue of almost every city in the diaspora, this would not have presented a problem. In other words, the Jewish elders were telling the Gentile believers that if they wanted to grow in their understanding of the Torah, they could learn how to do so in the synagogue. Moreover, because most Gentile believers would have been worshiping in the synagogues, the Jerusalem leadership knew that these new believers would be hearing the Torah each week. In their wisdom, they knew the reality of Yeshua's teaching that the sheep know my voice and follow me. The Torah is the voice of Yeshua, and these young lambs would hear and follow. Thus, Acts 15, far from downplaying the role of Torah in the life of non-Jewish believers, rather provides ample encouragement for them to pursue the Torah at their own pace. Gentiles grafted in. We have seen that Abraham, the father of our faith, heard God's voice and guarded God's Torah. We also saw that the Torah itself made provision for the Gentiles to relate to it. Next, we looked at Isaiah's magnificent prophecy to the Gentile remnants of believers concerning their relationship to Torah and Israel's covenant. After that, we learned that Yeshua instructed his followers to teach the Gentiles the Torah, as the elders of the Young Jerusalem Fellowship knew that the Gentile converts would hear and pursue it. Now we come to one of the most important passages concerning the relationship between Gentile and Jewish believers in Yeshua. We are referring to Romans 11, verses 11 through 21. To be sure, this passage does not speak about the Torah. However, it does teach that Gentile believers have a significant relationship with Israel. It is only a matter of reasoning that, since Gentile believers are closely connected to Israel, then they must also have a close connection to the Torah, just as Deuteronomy 4 implies. In Romans 11, verses 11 through 21, Shaul provides one of the most exciting truths in the Brit Chadashah for Gentile believers. Elsewhere, he had described unbelieving Gentiles as those who were, quote, uncircumcised, foreigners to the covenants of the promise, without hope, far away, end of quote. Ephesians 2, verses 11 through 13. And pagan idol worshippers, 1 Corinthians 12, verse 2. In contrast, because of what Messiah Yeshua did for these countless numbers of non-Jewish people, they have now been brought near and grafted in to Israel. There is some difference of opinion among the scholars about exactly into what the Gentiles are grafted. Some say that they, along with Jewish believers, are grafted into Yeshua. But that does not do the passage or the context justice. Wilson states it best when he observes, quote, "But this view confuses the expression, root of Jesse or root of David, with root of the olive tree. The flow of the context supports the conclusion that the root represents the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the faithful forefathers of the Jews," end of quote. Thus, this passage is telling us that Gentile believers in Yeshua have a significant relationship with Israel through being grafted in. Again, let us permit Wilson to summarize this beautiful truth for us. Quote, "Thus the church, firmly planted in Hebraic soil, finds its true identity in connection with Israel. The church is fed, sustained, and supported by that relationship." End of quote. What then does it mean in practical terms for Gentiles to be grafted into the olive tree of Israel? As stated elsewhere in this book, it does not mean that Gentile believers are now Jews. That, as we have stated, is a matter of physical descent. Rather, it is the fulfillment of Isaiah's prophecy. Gentiles can now benefit from the covenants, resulting in a living and active relationship with the Torah. Remember what Ephesians 2, verses 11 through 13 says. "Remember that formerly, you who are Gentiles by birth, you were separate from Messiah, excluded from citizenship in Israel and foreigners and strangers to the covenants of the promise. But now you have been brought near through the blood of Messiah." The Gentile believers have not been grafted into France, nor have they been brought near to China or Mexico. Rather, because of Messiah, they are, quote, "no longer foreigners and aliens, but fellow citizens with God's people and members of God's household," end of quote. They have been made part of the commonwealth of the children of Israel, an inheritance with Israel. Lest there be any doubt about the new relationship between Gentile believers and the covenanted children of Israel, let us turn to Ezekiel 47. Here the prophet looks far ahead of his own time, and even of our present age. He prophesies concerning the coming messianic age when Yeshua will be seated on the throne of David in Jerusalem. This will also be the time, according to Ezekiel, when the final land inheritance is divided among the people of Israel. However, we see in verses 21 through 23 that there will be others desiring to live among the people of Israel. These are Gentile believers. The Lord at that time will instruct Israel with the following word regarding the distribution of the inheritance. Quote, "You are to distribute this land among yourselves according to the tribes of Israel. You are to allot it as an inheritance for yourselves and for the aliens who have settled among you and who have children." Indicated in this book that, among other things, the Torah serves as the ketubah, the sacred marriage document specifying the conditions for the divine marriage between God and Israel. This means that Israel is the bride of God, a fact quite adequately affirmed in the rest of the Tanakh. See, for example, the prophecy of Hosea. Yet, as we read the Brit Chadashah, we learn that the church is considered to be the bride of Messiah. What is the situation here? Does God have two brides? Is he a polygamist? Of course not. Or is it possible that, as some have suggested, God divorced one bride, Israel, to marry another, the church? That cannot be either. Jeremiah speaks concerning this when he affirms God's everlasting covenant with the physical children of Israel in 31, verses 35 through 37. Shaul of Tarsus also affirms the continual existence of the physical people of Israel in Romans chapter 9 through chapter 11. The best solution to this problem is to assert that God has always had one bride, his chosen people. His bride has always been Israel, remnant Israel. All along, this has been enlarged to include those grafted into Israel, the Gentile believers. Since, therefore, God has only one bride, it would then follow that the same ketubah still defines this divine marriage, the Torah. The cycle of worship. Finally, we need to ask one question. Where are the commanded worship times that God gave to his people? We can look long and hard through the Brit Chadashah without finding a specified time of worship for the people of God. Yet all we need to do is open to Leviticus 23, and a whole worship cycle is before us. This cycle contains 7 or 8 specified times when God's holy community gathers for precious worship before the Holy One. Most of these special appointed times, Moadim in Hebrew, are occasions of great joy and praise. One day, Yom Kippur, is a more solemn occasion. In short, these are the times when Israel was called to remember what God did for them as a nation, both physically and spiritually. The cycle of the Moadim was designed by God to proclaim in every generation, year by year, the good news of the Messiah and his work of redemption in our lives. See also Hebrews chapter 4, verse 2. Accordingly, it should not surprise us that the Lord commanded these special days to be observed, quote, throughout your generations, wherever you live, end of quote. Leviticus 23, verses 14 and 21. What about the non-Jewish members of God's family? Are they to be left out of the singing and dancing, the celebrating of the Lord's redemptive work in their lives? Are they to be denied gathering for special meals, hearing the shofar sound, or living for a week in a special sukkah? Yet these are the specified times of worship taught in the Torah and which Yeshua celebrated with his Talmidim, disciples. The history of redemption and the worship of the Redeemer were clearly intended to be celebrated by all of God's people throughout the generations through the Moadim. This includes the Gentile believers, as they are part of the same redemptive history. For those unfamiliar with the Moadim, we refer you to chapter 3, The Torah, A Way of Life, as an introduction to the subject. Summary. We have attempted in this section to present the biblical evidence supporting this thesis, that non-Jewish believers in Yeshua have a meaningful and significant relationship to the Torah of Moshe. Through this relationship, God himself instructs his children to embrace the full revelation of his grace in their lives. That full revelation consists of the whole of Scripture, including the Torah. Believing Israel in the first century was a mighty light to the nations. As a result, many from those nations came to faith and were grafted in to the holy community. The holy community is the Torah community. May the holy community in this present generation also become a light to the nations, bringing many into the way, the truth, and the life, Yeshua himself. According to our understanding, is the Torah for me? Yes. For you? Are you grafted in? Then yes, the Torah is for the holy community. Chapter 5. Why follow the Torah? In a sense, this chapter might be considered a continuation of chapter 3, which dealt with the purposes of the Torah. However, the thrust here primarily concerns the motivations for following the Torah, rather than its purposes per se. Hence, there are several reasons why the Torah is to be lived. We have not presented these in order of importance. They are meant to be considered equally. As we do so, a more complete picture should unfold. Because God tells us to. One word frequently used to describe much of the content of the Torah is the Hebrew mitzvah. This simply means commandment. It is something God has told us to do. Don't be frightened by the concept, as if it is something only for the Tanakh. Although Jewish scholars are quick to assert that there are 613 commandments in the Torah, New Testament scholars have noted that there are over 1,000 such commandments in the Brit Chadashah. A commandment is a commandment. After all, what is the difference between celebrating Shavuot and choosing elders to govern your fellowship? Both are commanded. Torah gives definition. What does it mean to be Jewish? As noted earlier in the book, the Torah is the only authoritative document which answers this question. Many Jewish traditions are purely cultural, but the Torah presents a required lifestyle of holiness that is cross-cultural. Whether from Morocco or Brooklyn, Jewish people are bound together by certain practices, such as circumcision and eating kosher, that are taught in the Torah. It is the Torah, then, that gives the descendants of Jacob their identity. Believing in Yeshua only makes that identity complete. Because it is who we are. Personally, we like this reason the most because it solves all of the problems for both Jewish and non-Jewish people. If we follow Torah only because it is commanded, it can easily turn into legalism. Let us enter by a different door altogether. Let us enter the arena of Torah through the door of our identity in Messiah and see where it leads us. The scripture teaches us a critical truth. In bringing us to faith in Yeshua, God has made us into completely new people. We are new creations, with the Messiah living in us. Moreover, we are receivers of and partakers in the Brit Chadashah. Jeremiah 31 teaches that God promises to write Torah on our hearts when He makes us new. Do not miss the full implications of that. Torah is written on our hearts. Among other things, this means that Torah is part of our basic makeup as believers in Yeshua. The new creation man or woman, therefore, should only do what comes naturally to him or her. In this case, it means living out what is written in the Word, all of the Word. The mirror. Why do we follow Torah? Because it is who we are as new creations. When we read of the redeemed person as described by the precepts of Torah, we are, in reality, reading a description of who God has made us in the Messiah. Let us return again to the concept of the mirror image referred to in James 1, verses 22 to 25. Here we learn the importance of being doers of the word instead of listeners only. The illustration is of a person looking at himself in a mirror, but verse 25 describes that mirror as the Torah. Though translated law in nearly every English translation, it is actually Torah. He who does not do the word is one who looks at his face in the Torah and immediately forgets what he looks like. In that state, therefore, he does not do the word. But the person who sees himself in the mirror, the Torah, and remembers what he looks like, this is the one who does the word. When we look into the mirror of the Torah, our reflection is that of a redeemed person as described therein. The individual teachings, in essence, describe what the redeemed one looks like. Because it is Yeshua who has made us new, made us the righteousness of God, 2 Corinthians 5:21. All that is left for us to do is to choose to walk in that new life, the righteous life of Yeshua, the life of Torah. Therefore, we do not follow Torah as though it is merely a list of do's and don'ts. We follow it because it is written on our hearts. It is who we are as new creations. It comes naturally to us because God has made us into new people. But unless we know what our real spiritual identity is, we can't enter into the whole realm of our new life in Messiah that is available through the Torah.